Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Good afternoon and welcome to Family First with five-time author and top speaker Randy Rolfe. Your family may be facing a variety of issues that you'd like addressed. No two families in the world face identical problems, but Randy has seen almost all of the difficulties families today face, and she and her expert guests have the answers that you seek. Now, here is your host, Randy Rolfe.
Hello and welcome to Family First. I'm your host, Randy Rolfe, and I welcome you to our discussion today. We're going to be talking about helping kids with school struggles. When a child struggles to learn, it can snowball into a much bigger problem as they get older and up in the school experience, and parents worry about behavior in school, social skills, math, reading, and writing problems, organizational challenges, and even how to interact with teachers, whether to consider medications, and more. Especially in a competitive job market, parents feel more pressure than ever in the early childhood years to see that their children succeed in school. My guest today is Dr. Richard Selznick, who has many years' experience helping families to resolve these problems. He's the author of the new book, School Struggles, A Guide to Your Shutdown Learner's Success, which builds on the well-received information in his previous book, The Shutdown Learner, Helping Your Academically Discouraged Child. He offers practical, straightforward advice, which has helped educators, school psychologists, and parents for several decades. Dr. Selznick shows parents and teachers how to address the problems felt by struggling students and how to help them learn to their full ability. Dr. Selznick is a psychologist, a nationally certified school psychologist, a graduate school professor at St. Joseph's University, which is near where I live in Pennsylvania, and a university professor of pediatrics. He's also director of the Cooper Learning Center, where he oversees a program that assesses and treats a broad range of learning and school-based behavioral problems in children. The Cooper Learning Center is a division of the Department of Pediatrics of Cooper University Hospital. A down-to-earth presenter who discusses difficult topics in non-jargon terms, which I really appreciated in his book, he has presented to educators even in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, as well as across our country. States. He focuses on helping teachers and parents to choose the best options for each individual child, recognizing their uniqueness. Dr. Selznick's books have been chosen by school districts for professional training, and he's recently been keynote speaker at a number of events. He's a native of New York and lives in Haddonfield, New Jersey now, and his website is shutdownlearner.com. So welcome to Family First, Richard Selznick.
Hi, Randy. Thank you for having me.
So much. My pleasure. I really enjoyed reading your book because it is so accessible. And I know from your long experience, that's why you made it that way. I wanted to ask you first, how did you become interested in children's struggles in school?
That's a good question. It brings back a lot of memories. I was a young teacher, a high school English teacher, and then later a reading teacher. And there was a boy in my class, actually back in Staten Island, who it was the beginning stages of what was then the resource room movement. And I remember taking him down, you know, he was kind of a class clown style child, you know, giving people a hard time. He was in third or fourth grade. And I remember taking this boy down the hall, to screen him. You know, I didn't really know how to do extensive testing like I do now, but I did a kind of a reading screening with him. And he kind of looked at me, and I would, you know, give him the pre-primer word list, you know, typical words like the and cat, that kind of stuff. And this boy, I think his name was Matthew, just kind of shrugged at me, and I thought he was kind of fooling around and class clowning again, but even though we were one-on-one, and it turned out he was severely dyslexic, and it has stayed with me to this day. I've met thousands of dyslexic kids and kids with reading disabilities, and I continue to be struck by how challenged it makes everyone's lives, you know, the child, the family, and et cetera, you know, so it's been an ongoing kind of issue for me and both professionally, and, you know, trying to help parents to do what I think are, you know, sensible steps to take, that kind of thing. So that's the
great. Let's say right at the beginning, because you explain it so well in your book, that dyslexia doesn't mean that you read everything backwards. It's a much more complex kind of thing, and all kinds of gradations. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think I recently wrote a blog about on the website where I talked about, you know, the thing about dyslexia is, and it's, I love this. I encourage people to do this experiment where, you know, go to your friends and your family members, and it doesn't matter who. And if you ask somebody, well, you know, tell me, you know, Randy, what's dyslexia? And everyone, it's like we've been nationally hypnotized to believe, you know, so people will respond things like, well, isn't that when, and then it comes, dot, 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 you know, like, isn't that when you are reading upside down and backwards? And I believe at this stage of my career, I have tested thousands of kids with reading disabilities, dyslexia, and I still have not really met a child who has upside down and backward reading. So it's a fundamentally different kind of experience than what we understand as, and I think it's one of the most misunderstood syndromes that exist. And it's in the popular culture. It's not even that it's, you know, a medical syndrome that's misunderstood. It's like everybody has an opinion on it.
Yeah, that's so sad because, like the boy you were just talking about, they can just sort of not get it, and it's not that they read backwards; they just don't get the whole recognition sounding out kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, like the boy I was referring to, a vast majority of the kids that I have seen over the years, and I believe a vast majority of kids that are referred for special education are ones that have this core difficulty with, you know, what's called decoding. That's a bit of a jargon word, you know, basically phonics, you know, reading fluency. You know, I think that a significant number of kids that I see who are labeled ADD or ADHD come in with core difficulty with breaking words down into their component parts and reading fluently. So that affects everything. You know, it's a tremendous hurdle for little kids to get over. And if they don't get over it, then school struggles kick in, you know?
And they start going on a downward spiral where they get diagnosed with a real disability rather than it's just they missed the skill set at that early stage. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think of it, a skill set at an early stage. You know, that as I mentioned in school struggles, I tend to think of these kids as having sort of a soup pot of different variables. You know, certainly I'm not denying that some of these kids that I'm talking about have attention deficit issues, but so many of them have other things like this, you know, core learning problem, reading problem that I'm referring to. So it's a skill set that early on is often missed or often picked up on fairly late, you know, like by third grade or fourth grade when, you know, the child could have had 3 good years of a fairly focused and targeted remediation.
Yeah, so Tell me what inspired you to write your first book, The Shutdown Learner. Obviously, there's a, there's a lot of research done. Yeah. There's a lot of medical involvement, wanting to medicate when the kids don't pay attention. But you're saying sometimes they don't pay attention because they just don't understand what's going on.
You know, in The Shutdown Learner, it's really a book of stories in some ways, and these are all, I'm writing it from my perspective. It's not a scientific book. I mean, it's a book about kids that I have known and adults over the years. And I, as we're talking, I'm picturing a boy named Danny or a boy named Alex and a girl, there's so many of the kids who I saw. They typically had a fairly consistent profile, and it's mostly a profile that overlaps with dyslexia, that maybe is dyslexia, but it was a profile of kids. I called them Lego kids. They were great with spatial thinking, visual thinking, artistic, hands-on activities. But the other side of the coin was that they were really struggling with reading, spelling, and writing. And I saw the effects over the years, and that became shut down. You know, I discussed it as the air leaking out of the tire over time. You know, I try to use imagery like that for parents and teachers to, you know, because that's what makes sense to me. You know, for a child, the air was leaking out of the tire over the years, you know? And then by fourth grade, fifth grade, you start to see them kind of going, oh, I just hate this. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm shut down. And trying to get these kids to not shut down, to not become discouraged, ultimately not to drop out, even some of them, was incredibly challenging. And that was kind of the core of the book.
That's neat. So how did you move on to the School Struggles book, A Guide to Your Shutdown Learner's Success?
Well, the school struggles was more, Shutdown Learner was primarily focusing on this style of child where, you know, and they're not all shut down. I use that term because I was mostly thinking about the boys who were, primarily the boys who were kind of, you know, making school, giving people a really hard time because of these issues. The girls were a little bit more, you know, socially acceptable. So I called them like style too. Shutdown Learners, you know, they were more pleasant, but they were still struggling. But School Struggles was more, you know, moms are the drivers of the engine that I work with in sense of like, it's the moms that typically contact me. Every once in a while a dad might, but it's usually the dads are dragged in. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
I want to talk about my child, you know, the mom, you know, the dad's here to be, you know, all right, look, I had this when I was a kid, but my sense was that the moms in particular were worrying a lot. You know, that they were filled with anxiety. You know, that they were, the original title of the book was something like, you know, what's keeping you awake at night? You know, like the stuff that's keeping, as a mom, the stuff that's keeping you awake. And I was trying to tap into the thing. So I tried to write all these essays that are in here that are about sort of the common worries that occur around school struggling issues. So that's why the sections are, you know, section one is sort of we're worried about the kids' reading skills. And then section two is more, you know, I kind of think of it as on the side of the road, you know, the struggling on the school, the ADHD side of the road, you know, then the organizational side of the road because of another image that I use where kids are sort of there's some kids that are on the smooth road, you know, they're not the struggling types. They're on the rougher road, and that's what this book was about. Like, all right, when your kid's on a rougher road, what are those issues that you're worried about? And that's what I was trying to tap into.
Yes, I was fascinated by that distinction, and it was so interesting to me that it's not a black or white thing that your rougher road kid needs to get Ritalin and the smoother road kid you just ignore. There's such a wide variety between where there's so many things that you can do as a parent or a caring teacher. So how would you describe the difference between a smoother road and a rougher road? Because I was fascinated that the focus was also on how the child feels psychologically.
Yeah.
If they get frustrated and hate what they're doing because they feel inadequate, then they don't exhibit the skills that they might very easily be able to develop if it was addressed.
Now, it's a great and complex question. I guess like when the coffee kicks in, go on for about an hour on what you just that one question alone.
Okay.
but you know, I think it's how I when I talk to parents, this is what came about: the smooth road and the rough road. You know, I tend to see kids that are on, let's say, take the smooth road kids. And these are kids who, when they're very little in preschool, you know, they're learning their letters, they're learning their sounds, they're starting to pick up on sight words, their behavior is pretty good, they're socializing, everybody's sort of patting themselves on the head, you know, back, you know, what great parents we are and aren't we wonderful, and the kid's just moving along. And I'm not saying they're not going to have any difficulty down the road, you know, little bumps, but they kind of have a smooth road on through college, you know, everybody's, you know, they're doing okay. And then my joke is, and then there's everybody else. You know, that there's everybody else. So then there's all these kids, and a significant number of kids who are at 4 years old, 5 years old, you know, they're not learning their letters so well, or they're not, they're rolling around circle time because language processing is hard for them, or following directions is hard, and teachers are starting to get a little bit frustrated with them, and the parents are wondering, what's wrong with my kid? Why isn't he learning like my other kid learned, you know? And these are rough road kids. And then by third grade, fourth grade, those potholes start to kick in, and there's no way around them. That's one of the frustrating parts. They're not, you know, it's not something that you can absolutely prevent. It's just the way it is. And also, it could be temperament. You know, temperament. You know, there are kids that I worked with a little boy this week who, you know, this kid, every time he heard the word no, he was like, oh, you know, freaking out and upset. And, you know, it's a rougher road when the other siblings are looking at him like, what's his problem, you know? So that's what I think of with the rough side of the road. And as you asked, Randy, there is an emotional component to all of this. You know, there's my sense of it, and I don't know how to quantify this, research it, or, you know, is it there's an intangible aspect to how we reach these kids. You know, if we could get these kids who are on the rougher side to sort of somehow connect to the idea that they're not such damaged goods, or they're not, you know, disabled and brain injured or something, they might feel, okay, you know, this guy likes me. He's here to help a little bit. All right, I'll work on my reading. You know, there's something that gets transmitted to the kid, you see, and that gives him a sense of emotional fuel. It gets him encouraged. Gets put to, I call it, fuel in his tank. You know, he starts to feel a little bit better about himself. And that's kind of the process.
Yeah, often if a teacher identifies today a problem with a child in the classroom, they're immediately given a whole battery of tests and told that they have a problem, and they self-identify so quickly that somehow they are, like you said, damaged goods. And I love your approach that you try not to label them or make them feel inadequate. You just try to help them catch up with that relationship. And you emphasize that so much, that the relationship, whether it's parent-child or teacher-child, preferably both.
You know, so thank you. So many of the kids that I see are, I kind of jokingly say, that, you know, like a circus tent, you know, the big tent. Under the big tent of normal is a lot of variation. If you know what I mean. It's like,
yes.
You know, there's a lot of variation under normal. So most, I would say that 95% of the kids that I see, to me, are normal. They're just kids. You know, they might be struggling with reading, or they might have a difficulty waiting in line, or they might get pushy or whatever, or they might have inattention. But to me, they're normal. You know, there's tremendous variation under normal. And I think we forget that, and we're so focused on, you know, the broken part, in a sense, you know, like disabled, not abled. And I'm like, and I know people somehow are comforted by, oh, I got the diagnosis. I'm just not, you know. I'm more like,
I totally agree. Dr. Selznick, we're up on a break, so I'm going to interrupt you, but I want to come back and talk about why it's important to address these issues early and avoid labeling the children. So please keep listening. We are talking with Dr. Richard Selznick, who's written the book about school struggles that really is, it really addresses how to help kids when you realize that they don't feel good about school. We'll be right back.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RandyRolfe.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back to Family First. We're talking about how to help kids with school struggles. And our guest today is Dr. Richard Selznick, who is a psychologist and nationally certified school psychologist and director of the Cooper Learning Center. And for almost 30 years, he's been helping families and teachers and administrators help kids that are struggling in school. And I really love that emphasis on the struggle. It's not constantly testing the skills and, okay, if they're doing all right, that's just fine. If the parent realizes that they're struggling or the teacher sees them struggling, it's going to show up later if they're not enjoying the learning process. So we've talked a lot about the different categories that some kids just have a smoother road and some have a rougher road, and our job is to help smooth that road a little. It won't necessarily get smooth like the smooth road, but you can make it a lot easier. And so we were just talking about how to see the signals and why it's so important to address these things early. So Dr. Selznick, can you tell us what are the signals that the moms you were talking about recognize, and what can we do about it?
Back to one point about that smooth road and rough road is
sure.
I just want to amplify what you just said about, because parents so often how do we fix it? And I'm like, I'm not so sure we can fix it. We can smooth some of these potholes, so to speak, but I don't, you know, so it's not, it doesn't become a fully smooth road, but just like you said, early on, I think that it's so much of this is tied into that whole, you know, unfolding development with reading, because I do think with reading, spelling, and writing that is the core task of early childhood in many respects. That I, you know, like for example, when my kids were younger, they're now about to finish college and young adults, there was one hurdle I wanted them to get over, and that was what I called the decoding hurdle. You know, so that early on, some of those indicators are things like not picking up on your letters when you're 4 or 5 years old, or not quite associating the sounds, or being somewhat weaker with things like rhyming activities, you know, some of those subtle language processes. I think that those are skills. We don't have to jump necessarily to thinking learning disability, but those are indicators of later struggling. I think that when a mom picks up on this early, they are frequently told things like, oh, well, he's a boy. You know how boys are. Or if he only tried harder, you know, or he doesn't pay attention. Well, he may not be able to fully pay attention because of these kind of subtle issues. And I think that if you can, early on, the school may not want to test the child because they don't feel that he's effectively failing enough or behind enough, which is, it's hard to be so far behind in first grade, say. But if a mom is, or dad or whatever, suggests feeling that, you know, something seems a little bit awry. If you can, you know, typically it's out of pocket expense. If you can find someone in your community who can do a decent evaluation, it doesn't have to be such a heavy handed assessment, but something where an assessment that decides how good to go is your child. You know, for the next phase. So if your child in kindergarten, my testing would be like, well, how good to go is this kid for going into first grade? You know, or if he's now going into second or third grade, whatever. You know, what are those foundational skills like? How good to go is the child? That to me is a more fundamental question that a parent should be asking, or should, that a professional in the community who understands this stuff can be assessing and evaluating.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Now, you urge those who are working with a struggling child to go back to basics. And our lives today are so complicated with all the testing and the digital distractions and everything. Mm-hmm. And getting back to basics, and you talk about the five stages of reading and how to recognize from, like you started to say, kindergarten to first grade and then up through third grade, that those making sure they don't miss these basic understanding is so critical. Can you talk a little more about those basic stages?
Sure. Yeah, sure. To me, there's a section in the book. You know, I have a few sections. I guess I'm old enough at this point to have what I call old school concepts that we don't hear about enough in education anymore. And for me, or in psychology, one of the old school concepts was from one of the most renowned researchers from Harvard, Dr. Jean Chawl, who was a wonderful reading educator, psychologist. And she in the 60s and 70s highlighted the stages of reading, probably writing development as well. And it's a roadmap that really anyone, I use it all the time in my assessments in the sense of, okay, what stage is the child in? Because once you identify where they are in these unfolding stages, then you know what to do next. So for example, I think of it in terms of riding on the bike. This is how parents understand it. So stage zero is kind of like he doesn't know how to get on the bike yet. You know, that's like preschool. But they're, you know, going into first grade, typically, all right, you're getting on the bike, you're learning how, you know, you're taking little baby steps, you're able to read some sight words, you're making little steps toward basic phonics, you know, little words like consonant, vowel, consonant words. And then stage two, you're on the bike. Typically it corresponds with second grade through middle third grade. And you're on the bike, but you're not riding, you know, very quickly, but you're kind of, you know, you're wobbling along a little bit more independently, but you need to do a lot more practice in that stage. So many of the kids with dyslexia and reading disabilities get stuck at these early stages. You could be 15 and still in stage two. You see, that's what's so frustrating to people, and so it produces tremendous anger because you're still struggling with phonics, even though you might be in 15 or 20 or an adult.
I really like that bicycle analogy because most of us who learn to ride a bike, you know, there's a point where you say, okay, this is worth working at. It's going to be fun. But if you get stuck at, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. My legs are too short. Yeah, right. It keeps falling over. I scratched my knee. Right. You're not going to do it.
You're not going to do it. You're going to look around. If everybody is going around the track kind of smoothly, quickly, easily, and you're wobbling along and everybody's zipping by you and they're watching you, how many people are going to, oh, I'm so inspired by these other people zipping by me? They're not. They're discouraged. They're shut down. Or they give up. Now that's why you have to, you know, somebody has to come over to them and say, hey, look, we can work on this. This isn't like tragedy here. We can work on this. That's for the positive side. But it is hard for the people that are not wired well for reading, you know, the shutdown learner style people, the dyslexic style. It helps parents to understand this stuff. So stage three typically corresponds from middle third grade all the way up to, like, say, middle school, where now Gene Chawla talked about now you're no longer learning to read, but you're reading to learn. And now you're in that comprehension phase and develop, you know, higher order thinking and all that nice stuff, you know, big chapter books. My issue is that too often, I believe, kids that are in early stage one, you know, on the bike, you know, just barely able to ride, are being asked to comprehension questions and an overemphasis of things that should come later on. And then they get frustrated because it works simply too hard.
Right, right. And then they can just shut down, as mm-hmm. you've explained. So backing up, then you talk about instructional levels, which I thought mm-hmm. was such a valuable concept. Can you explain those three levels?
I'm glad you're picking up on those. Those are the two one of the three old school concepts that are in the book. Again, I don't hear about it enough. You know, we talk RTI, you know, response to intervention and all this other business, which has merit. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying that I don't hear enough. To me, along with the stages, almost everything, probably even in life, not just reading, falls in terms of instructional levels. So essentially there are three levels: independent, instructional, frustration. With the independent level, let's talk about it like a little child wants to make his or her lunch. You know, put it into non-academic terms. So as a mom or as a parent, you might say, all right, does this child really have the ability to take stuff out of the refrigerator, you know, pull out the aluminum foil, pack the lunch? You know, there are a lot of steps in making lunch. But you may be able to size up that the child really is independent and can do that by his or herself. So that's the independent level. The instructional level is where, you know, maybe the child can do, say, 80% of it. You know, she could pull out the peanut butter, put the toast in the bread in the, you know, the toaster. But something about packing the lunch is not quite getting there. So that's the instructional level. That means you can do most of it, but you need some assistance. So with reading, let's say your child's in third grade and you're asked to read a third grade level book, but you know, geez, there's some tough words in here like porcupine and, you know, institute or whatever. I mean, the smooth road kids are reading those words. The kids that are struggling a little bit, maybe a little still in stage two, may need a little bit of assistance. Just assuming that they can do it by themselves is not going to work. So give them a little help. That's the instructional level. The third level, which is sadly the one that I think many of the kids that are shutdown learners and the school struggling types, is the frustration level. And that's just too hard. You know, you can use any number of images that could work for you. You know, they're in the deeper end of the pool, and, you know, they don't have the swimming skills. Worksheets that are too hard for them. I call them worksheet burnout disorder. These kids are getting worksheets to death, and they can't handle them. And or given reading material that's simply over their head. So then the ADD features kick really in because you're off task and you're like the boy I talked about at the beginning. And this kid was sitting in a regular third grade class and he couldn't read Cat and the. You see?
Wow.
So that's frustration
yes.
level. As I said in the book, dangerous waters keep out, you know? And that's the part that so many of the kids that I see are really in frustration level work. And that is in some ways, between that and the stages, they're kind of in place in, say, stage three when they're really in stage one or whatever, you know, whatever it is, you know, but it's too hard for them.
So what you try to do then is to reassure them that there's a way to get more comfortable with this stuff. Is that right? So you kind of back up?
I think that it's so complicated. You know, you can imagine I'm not in the school, so I'm on the outside. Parent comes in. So much of this is parent work we're doing now, in the sense parent education. I mean, I pride myself on trying to present this stuff to parents in, like we're doing now, I hope, in down-to-earth terms so that they can walk out going, okay, I get it. I get it. So step one to me is really getting the parents to understand this in terms that they can kind of get their mind around. The next step, the kid can, you know, a lot of this is skill building. So if the child and the family can buy in, then it's like, okay, well, let's do some good tutoring. You know, let's target those skills. Or if the school can do it, you know, that becomes a little more complicated because they may or may not either have the ability or not view the child as bad enough or whatever. But, you know, targeting the skills and give, you know, it's like a sports skill. You know, if your kid is, you know, you want to have him play tennis, well, you need to target your forehand, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. So, when you approach it this way, so many parents are already used to having all these IPOs and numbers and tests and stages and thrown at them. And so I'm curious, how do they respond when you say, well, let's set some of that jargon aside and just look at what you're observing and what your child is going through?
You know, I'd like to believe that they respond pretty positively and that people, we all of us in the field have our successes and our cases that we've lost or cases that we didn't, you know, connect with, or they thought, oh, this guy's whatever. I don't know. I think for the most part, I like to believe parents respond, and kids. I still, even though I'm getting older, I still think kids respond to me pretty well. And I try to go through their reports, and I do this even online. I mean, I've had people send me reports, and we set up a distance kind of consultation where I review their data, you know, because they get so many of these numbers, like you're saying. I mean, if I said to you right now, your child has a vocabulary score of 7, would you know what that meant?
No.
You have no idea. Or similarity score of 13. Is that good? Is that bad? What is that? You know, and so I try and put these things. Now I know what it means. It means your child's in the 84th percentile on categorical thinking. It's probably a good thing for him. But the 7 in vocabulary, that's trouble. You see, but trying to translate that for parents is really tough because frequently they're sitting in these special ed meetings, feeling completely overwhelmed and intimidated. And I'm not saying the team is doing anything wrong per se. It's just that it's a hard spot for them to be in. And then they get overwhelmed, even really, really smart people with all kinds of degrees. I mean, doctors and lawyers and stuff. They walk out of these meetings traumatized half the time. You know, like, I don't even know what they were saying, but my kid's got a disability or doesn't have one. I don't know.
Right. I love the image that you give of Columbo, and I don't know how many of the listeners are old enough to remember that show, but can you describe that, how parents can
the strategy
be non-confrontational, but can still
parents
get the information?
I try to help parents not to kind of go at schools in a kind of more full frontal way. You know, I'm of school stock. My dad was a principal. You know, my grandmother was a public school teacher. I was a public school. So I empathize. I know how hard it is to be a teacher. On the other hand, special ed can be really hard for parents. And sometimes they feel like people aren't giving them enough understanding. So I trained them to go Columbo. You know, like Columbo was the detective, Peter Falk. Who always was scratching his head and kind of going, you know, I'm a little confused here. Help me out. You know, he knew exactly what the answer was, but he was like, you know, can you tell me about that vocabulary score of 7? I know it's a number 7, but like, what does that mean? Is that good? Is that bad? Like, tell me, you know, that kind of stuff. Or I know you said here that he's not dyslexic. Can you help me out? Like, tell me about that. You know, trying to get parents to be a little bit more, you know, questioning and confused rather than direct and, you know, putting people on the defensive.
Yeah, I think that's so important because you really do want the teachers and the parents to work together if possible to address the issue.
You know? Yeah, ideally it's collaborative, and too often people come to me feeling frustrated, and it's too bad. I mean, I don't try to rev people up. I'm not trying to have them walk out of the office and go, blunt school at the school full frontal. I want them to try to work more collaboratively if they can.
Sounds good. Yes. And I've seen parents just overwhelmed and all these meetings and then the child sitting there wondering what are they all talking about and feeling sometimes they'll feel really special. Other times they'll feel completely behind the eight ball.
Well, that's also one of the kind of motivations in a sense behind Shutdown Learner too, because at the beginning of the book I talk about this kid is sitting there, he's sick of doctors, he's sick of hearing about ADD and 504, and he's just had it, you know, and he, you know, he's been hearing this almost all of his life. So he's sitting there in the waiting room with his turned around hat and, you know, kind of style that says screw everything. And, you know, there is a point where there's been so much talk about this stuff that the child can't help but feel there's something really seriously wrong with them.
Yeah, exactly. They just get that, and that's the perfect picture of the frustration. They just give up on themselves and wonder what the parents in school are worrying about. Dr. Selznick, we're up on another break, so we'll come back and get some more examples and talk about the practicalities of getting the help that your child might need.
Learn more. Live better. Voice America Health and Wellness.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters, whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance. Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RandyRolfe.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back. We're talking about helping kids with school struggles, and our guest today is Dr. Richard Selznick, who's a nationally certified school psychologist and highly qualified for this discussion. He's worked for over 25 years with parents and teachers. He's been a teacher himself. He also has kids, so he's been a parent. And he's also the author of the new book, School Struggles, A Guide to Your Shutdown Learner's Success, School Struggles. And that's a follow-up on the already well-received book, The Shutdown Learner, Helping Your Academically Discouraged Child. So we've been talking about how individual kids are and how the parents are the best they're in the best position to tell if a child is struggling. And the struggle part is what can highlight that there's something that needs to be addressed right away. And you shouldn't just wait and say, oh, he'll outgrow it, or he just has to work harder, because then you end up yelling and being frustrated yourself. So I wanted to ask you more about that, Dr. Selznick. You say a lot of parents just get so frustrated that there's something wrong with their child, that they should be working harder or studying longer, and they try to control the situation rather than addressing the basic problem.
Right. You mean the parents try to control the situation?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think that once you're seeing these indicators and you feel that there may be something amiss or awry, you know, if you can check it out, like I said before, I think it's a good thing to do. You know, assessments run the range depending upon effectively your zip code. Like if you're in Manhattan and New York City, you're going to have a pretty expensive zip code there, if you know what I mean. Depending upon what part of the country you're in and if you're located near a university or community, there's such variance in terms of what's out there. But there are some basic things to kind of look at in terms of, you know, usually it would be a psychologist who would kind of put, you know, assess a number of key areas that I tend to think of it like sort of spokes around a wheel, you know, that key areas of development like visual perceptual skills or language-based skills or reading skills and writing. So these various, so they're not, you know, they're not going in for a more narrow band assessment if you follow. And that's what I think is a reasonable first step.
That makes a lot of sense because these things do feed back and forth. It's, mm-hmm. They are behind in reading, then they're losing confidence and not making friends, and it's all related.
Right. Like I have no, in effect, investment in what spoke of the wheel. So let's just say the child came in and had significant problems with like a visual, perceptual, and something's off seemingly in the visual system. I might refer to an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, or I might if an auditory function, a language function, or reading. So you want to be kind of finding out what, you know, where is in effect the breakdown point and who would be the next logical person then to deal with. So if you go into a more narrow band assessment, then that person is going to usually see things from the narrow perspective, you know, like occupational therapy, I'm just throwing that out. You know, if you go into there, then, you know, they're not assessing language usually or reading skills. They're doing their own occupational therapy battery, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. So a lot of parents are concerned too, and schools, about social interaction, mm-hmm. and also the organizational executive. And I know we can't go into too much detail, but it's
right.
in your book. But if you can just highlight those, what they mean as far as making a child struggle.
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of the field in terms of ADD, and I'm using that term loosely, ADD, not ADHD. I know there's a lot of, okay, what is it actually? But it's tied in with what's called executive function difficulty. And I think that this makes a lot of sense. So think of the executive function, this is my understanding of it, like it's typically the frontal part of your brain that's guiding you and steering you. So a lot of the kids, more often than not, the boys, the girls seem to have pretty good executive functions from my observation. A lot of times the boys have pretty floppy rudders. I joke that they have like paper for rudders, you know, like a floppy loose rudder to their ship. You know, then they're out at sea kind of, you know, when the wind blows, it goes, they go that way. When it goes the other way, you know, they're not self-guiding. So what these executive function issues are things like, you know, they don't get started on tasks on their own. They don't follow through so well. They don't plan. They don't time manage, you know. And you don't know the parade. I sometimes feel like I can do a parade of bleary-eyed moms who've been yelling at these kids, you know, just get started. And, you know, I mean, it's tough. It's a real problem. But it's, and I don't want to even for a second say that I've got the cure for this because I don't even know there is, and I know that there are lots of programs to work on this stuff, but it's really, really hard. And it goes right on up to high school and it goes right on up into college. I've got kids that I've been trying to work on who are in local community colleges and get there. All right, how are you spending your day? Let me hear about, you know, where do you, you know, what time do you wake up and where do you go after you wake up? And, you know, like trying to get them to be a little bit more mindful, a little more aware of, you know, how they're steering their boat. That's, you know, what executive function organizational difficulties are. And it plagues people. This is a serious issue.
Yeah, it makes so much sense, and I think it's getting harder and harder because with usually the parents have jobs and the child has a longer time at school and there's no one actually the school may be very structured, but at home they don't have any guidance or model for structure.
Right, and kids are often adrift with the, you know, and I have my own drifting electronic stuff, you know, but iPads and, you know, going adrift on the internet or playing Xbox 360 Live. I mean, it's a whole other thing than when we were kids, you know.
Right. I wanted to ask you, what are the pluses and minuses of this whole digital revolution and how it is affecting children's ability to grasp these basic functions?
You know, it's a little bit like, you know, we got trouble in River City, you know, with the capital, you know, rhymes with tea and pool, you know, it's a little bit, we're all freaked out about it as parents. And I think that we don't, you know, it's, that's where I think the generation gap truly is. And, you know, there's this divide between the kids thinking, well, you're so old school, you don't get it. And I think there's some truth to that. But I also think the kids, the boys in particular, who are absorbing themselves in this quick medium have limited frustration tolerance. You know, to read a story for them is like walking across a desert. You know, they think they're just, it's a heroic activity because things come to them so easily when they're zipping along on, you know, destroying the universe on Xbox 360 Live, you know.
Right, and the weapons come, they can choose between five different weapons to get the job done. And
right. Zip, zip, clip, clip, boom, boom, you know. Why bother with a story that's going to take you a week to read? Are you kidding me? A week? I mean, that's an awful long time to read a book. Why would I do that?
Right. Now, does that lead you to suggest that parents try to limit the digital exposure, especially in those really early years?
I think so. You know, we kind of blew it on our own son, too. I mean, the pressure to have him interact socially around video games started to become great, so I don't want to be too hypocritical about it. But, yeah, I think that if you can set up some rules and parameters and have a backbone about it and say, look, you know, I have an essay on this recently. I called it Miller Time, you know, make it Miller Time, you know, like the kids earned the right to go on Xbox 360, you know, go ahead. You relax and we're relaxing. You've put in a good time of homework. You've done your stuff. Now relax. Go play your video games. But so often it's reversed. The kid just kind of comes home, plops himself on the video game for 4 or 5 hours, and then he begrudgingly does a little bit of work.
Yeah, I think that there's a common picture where everybody's tired. You know, the children come home from school and the parents come home from work and they all want to kind of veg out. Yeah. But there's more to be done and there's more for the parents to do to structure the evening for the kids. And then the kids have to do their homework. So it's an ongoing challenge for sure. And with the younger kids, it can be critical as far as their success in the future.
Yeah, yes. And it's the middle school. It's like fourth grade and up. The young kids, in terms of this electronic stuff, isn't, although I'm seeing more and more of it. I'm seeing little kids coming into my waiting room, like 6 years old. You know, they don't play with anything else, but they have their little phones and their little iPads, which is kind of troubling me a bit. But, you know, but I think it's really in fourth grade and up, especially with the boys, that you're really seeing this becoming a huge phenomenon.
Yes, I think I have a 5-year-old grandson, and he'll often ask his granddad for his phone to play some of the games, and we say, well, let's go run around the house first, or let's play a game, and let's read. And so we've really he does. He's young enough that he follows what we say rather than, okay, we'll play that later. When you're tired, we'll play that. Let's go get tired.
Don't you see it in restaurants, too? It bothers me, too, when I see families out and the child sitting there with the iPad instead of maybe I remember toughing it out. You know, it's like you had to put up with this adult conversation. You know, you had to deal with the fact that they wanted coffee and, you know, you had to, you know, try to take part in conversation. So many kids just are offline while they're out with adults, too. I don't know. I'm not sure where this is all going.
Yes, it's quite interesting. I was saying to my husband the other day that I see a situation where the husband's watching a game and the the mother's off doing her email or chatting with a friend, and the children are doing whatever.
Right. And, you know, I'm as guilty in many respects as the next person. I don't want to, you know, sound like I'm, you know, okay, I'm just reading my books. I mean, I'm certainly on my electronic stuff. And it's, you know, again, I don't know where this is all going, you know, but it'll be very interesting to see where it does.
Well, it is. I think that you've just hit the nail on the head as far as just if you see things are out of whack, then you need to get back to the basics and look at your structure, look at your interactions. And your book explains that so well. So
Thank you.
We just have a couple more minutes. I wanted to ask you to read passage, which I really, I mean, there's so many great passages that I've marked here. But on page 219, about how to create an environment of of clarity and understanding. So, like in the middle of the page where
Is it okay if I back up a little bit? Just so, I know you don't have too much time, but keep in mind. This is the end of the book, by the way, so the listeners understand. This is kind of my concluding thought.
Yes.
Always keep in mind that the formula of you give and you get is very basic, but far too many kids are not being held to that standard. They get without giving. They view playing video games as a right, not a privilege. There are very few rights. The rights of clothing, food, shelter, and parental protection are essential, but going on Facebook, playing Xbox, or driving a car are privileges. As the captains of the ship, you need to determine whether your child has earned a privilege or still needs to earn it. Such messages are important for all children, but particularly for those struggling on the rougher road. Without clarity of message, these children have a hard time seeing the line, reading the signals, or judging cause and effect. They do not easily see their own part when things do not go well. Impulsive thinking leads to academic and social difficulty. Clarity and structure from parents who set the course is the ticket to help struggling children see situations better and make choices that work for them, not against them. Listening to children, understanding them patiently, seeing them as works in progress will help you get through some tough times. One expression I heard many years ago spoken to parents who were concerned that their child was not measuring up or meeting expectations summed it up. It went something like this. This is a quote. Be patient. God isn't done with him yet. I think that was exactly on the money, and it helped the parents to calm down and not be so focused on the immediate problems. It allowed the parents to gain some perspective. So does the expression, this too shall pass. With virtually all child issues, remind yourself of this, and things will look a lot brighter in the morning.
Thanks so much, Dr. Selznick. That's at the end of the book. There's so much wonderful insights throughout the book on different areas.
Can I clarify the website?
Closing.
ShutdownLearner.com would get you there. ShutdownLearner.com or Dr. Selz, D-R-S-E-L-Z, I shortened it, drselz.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being our guest on Family First, Dr. Selznick, and he's the author of School Struggles, and you can find it anywhere. And it's a great help, whether you think your child is a smooth road or rough road or kid, this will really make a lot of sense. So thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed Family First. Please tune in to our program every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time, to join your host, Randy Rolfe, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. The weekend is here. Enjoy it with your family. And we hope to see you here next week.